Hoes, hoes. I lay down next to her, and Gramps tentatively sat down on the other side. Whoa, he said, I do believe this thing's alive. The three of us lay there sloshing around as Gramps turned this way and that. Gol darn, he said. Tears were streaming down Gram's face. She was giggling so hard. Gramps said, well, this ain't our marriage bed. That night, I dreamed that I was floating down a river on a raft with my mother. We were lying on our backs looking up at the high sky. The sky moved closer and closer to us. There was a sudden popping sound, and then we were up in the sky. Mama looked all around and said, we can't be dead. We were alive just a minute ago. In the morning, we set out for the Black Hills and Mount Rushmore, hoping to be there by lunchtime. No sooner were we in the car than Gramps said, so, what happened to PB's mother, and did PB get any more of those messages?
I hope everything turned out all right, Graham said. I'm a little worried about PB.
On the day after Phoebe showed her father the suspicious spots and the unidentifiable hair strands, another message appeared. You can't keep the birds of sadness from flying over your head, but you can keep them from nesting in your hair. Phoebe brought the message to school to show me. The lunatic again, she said. If he's already kidnapped your mother, why would he still be leaving messages? They're clues, she said. At school, people kept asking Phoebe about her mother's business trip to London. She tried to ignore them, but it wasn't always possible. She had to answer some other time. When Megan asked Phoebe what sights her mother had seen, Phoebe said, Buckingham Palace. Of course, Megan nodded knowingly. And Big Ben, and Phoebe was struggling. Shakespeare's birthplace. But that's in Stratford-on-Avon, Megan said. I thought your mother was in London. Stratford is miles away. Did she go on a day trip or something? Yes, that's what she did. She went on a day trip. Phoebe couldn't help it. She looked as if a whole family of the birds of sadness were nesting in her hair. In English class, Ben had to give his mythology report. He was nervous. He explained that Prometheus stole fire from the sun and gave it to man. Zeus, the chief god, was angry at man and at Prometheus for taking some of his precious sun. As punishment, Zeus sent Pandora, a woman, to man. Then Zeus chained Prometheus to a rock and sent vultures down to eat Prometheus's liver. In Ben's nervousness, he mispronounced Prometheus, so what he actually said was that Zeus sent vultures down to eat porpoise's liver. Mary Lou invited both me and Phoebe to dinner that night. When I phoned my father, he did not seem to mind, and I knew he wouldn't. All he said was, "That'll be nice for you, Sal. Maybe I'll go eat over at Margaret's." Chapter 25. Cholesterol. Dinner at the Finneys was an experience. When we arrived, Mary Lou's brothers were running around like crazed animals, jumping over the furniture and tossing footballs. Mary Lou's older sister, Maggie, was talking on the telephone and plucking her eyebrows at the same time. Mr. Finney was cooking something in the kitchen with the help of 4-year-old Tommy. Phoebe whispered, I am not too optimistic about the possibilities of this meal. When Mrs. Finney straggled in the door at 6 o'clock, Tommy and Dougie and Dennis tugged at various parts of her, all of them talking at once. Look at this, and Mom, 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 and me first. She made her way into the kitchen, trailing all three of them like a fishhook that has snagged a tangle of old tires and boots and other miscellaneous rubbish. She gave Mr. Finney a sloppy kiss on the lips, and he slipped a piece of cucumber into her mouth. Mary Lou and I set the table, although I think it was largely a wasted effort. Everyone descended on the table in a chaotic flurry, knocking over glasses and sending forks onto the floor and picking up plates, which did not match, Phoebe pointed out to me, and saying, "That's my plate, and I want the daisy plate, and give me the blue, and it's my turn for the blue plate." Phoebe and I sat between Mary Lou and Ben. In the center of the table was a whopping platter of fried chicken. Phoebe said, "Chicken? Fried? I can't eat fried foods. I have a sensitive stomach." She glanced at the three pieces of chicken on Ben's plate.
You really shouldn't eat that, Ben. Fried foods aren't good for you. First of all, there's the cholesterol. Phoebe removed two pieces of chicken from Ben's plate and put them back on the serving platter. Mr. Finney coughed. Mrs. Finney said, "You're not going to eat the chicken then, Phoebe?" Phoebe smiled. "Oh, no, Mrs. Finney. I couldn't possibly. Actually, Mr. Finney shouldn't be eating it either. I don't know if you're aware of this, but men should really be careful about their cholesterol." Mr. Finney stared down at his chicken. Mrs. Finney was rolling her lips around peculiarly. By this time, the beans had been passed to Phoebe. "Did you put butter on these beans, Mrs. Finney?" "Yes, I did. Is there something wrong with butter?" "Cholesterol," Phoebe said. "Cholesterol in the butter." "Ah," Mrs. Finney said. "Cholesterol." She looked at her husband. "Be careful, dear. There's cholesterol on the beans." I stared at Phoebe. I am sure I was not the only one in the room who wanted to strangle her. Ben pushed his beans to one side of his plate. Maggie picked up a bean and examined it. When the potatoes came around, Phoebe explained that she was on a diet and could not eat starch. The rest of us looked glumly down at our plates. There was nothing at all on Phoebe's plate. Mrs. Finney said, "So, what do you eat, Phoebe?" "My mother makes special vegetarian meals. Low calorie and no cholesterol. We eat a lot of salads and vegetables. My mother's an excellent cook." She never mentioned the cholesterol in all those pies and brownies her mother made. I wanted to jump up and say, "Phoebe's mother has disappeared, and that is why Phoebe is acting like a complete donkey." But I didn't. Phoebe repeated, "A truly excellent cook." "Marvelous," Mrs. Finney said. "And what do you propose to eat tonight? I don't suppose you have any unadulterated vegetables?" "Unadulterated," Mrs. Finney said. "It means unspoiled, without any butter or stuff added." "I know what it means, Phoebe," Mrs. Finney said. "I can eat unadulterated vegetables. Or if you have any red bean salad handy, or stuffed cabbage leaves, broccoli and lentil casserole, macaroni and cheese, vegetarian spaghetti." One by one, everyone at the table turned to stare at Phoebe. Mrs. Finney got up from the table and went into the kitchen. We heard her opening and closing cupboards. She returned to the doorway. "Muesli?" she asked Phoebe. "Can you eat muesli?" Phoebe said, "Oh, yes, I eat muesli for breakfast." Mrs. Finney disappeared again and returned with a bowl of dried-up muesli and a bottle of milk. "For dinner?" Phoebe asked. She gazed down at the bowl. "I usually eat it with yogurt on it, not milk," she said. Mrs. Finney turned to Mr. Finney. "Dear, did you buy yogurt this week?"
"Blasted, how could I forget the yogurt?"
Phoebe ate her dried-up muesli without milk. All through dinner, I kept thinking of Bi Banks and what it was like when we went to my grandparents' house for dinner. There were always tons of people, relatives and neighbors, and lots of confusion. It was a friendly sort of confusion, and it was like that at the Finneys. Tommy spilled two glasses of milk. Dennis punched Dougie, and Dougie punched him back. Maggie socked Mary Lou, and Mary Lou flipped a bean at her. Maybe this is what my mother had wanted, I thought. A house full of children and confusion. On the way home, I said, "Didn't everyone seem unusually quiet after dinner?" Phoebe said, "It was probably because of all that cholesterol sitting heavily on their stomachs." I asked Phoebe if she wanted to spend the weekend at my house. I'm not sure why I did this. It was an impulse. I had not yet invited anyone to my house. She said, "I guess. That is, if my mother is still..." She coughed. "Let's go ask my dad." In the kitchen, her father was washing the dishes. He was wearing a frilly apron over his white shirt and tie. "You're supposed to rinse the soap off," Phoebe said. "And is that cold water you're using? You're supposed to use really, really hot water to kill the germs." He didn't look at Phoebe. I thought maybe he was embarrassed to be caught doing the dishes. "You've probably washed that plate enough," Phoebe said. He had been rubbing it around and around with the dishcloth. He stopped and stared down at the plate. I could practically see the birds of sadness pecking at his head, but Phoebe was busy swatting at her own birds. "Did you call all of Mom's friends?" Phoebe asked.
"Phoebe," he said, "I'm looking into it. I'm a little tired. Do you mind if we don't discuss this now?"
"But don't you think we should call the police?"
"Phoebe."
"Sal wants to know if I can spend the weekend at her house."
"Of course," he said.
"But what if Mom comes back while I'm at Sal's? Will you call me? Will you let me know?"
"Of course."
"Or what if she telephones? Maybe I should stay home. I think I should be here if she calls."
"If she telephones, I'll have her call you at Sal's," he said.
"But if we don't have any news by tomorrow," Phoebe said, "we should definitely call the police. We've waited too long already. What if she's tied up somewhere and waiting for us to rescue her?" At home that night, I was working on my mythology report when Phoebe called. She was whispering. When she went downstairs to say goodnight to her father, he was sitting in his favorite chair, staring at the television, but the television wasn't on. If she did not know her father better, she would have thought he had been crying. "But my father never cries," she said. Chapter 26. Sacrifices. The weekend was unbelievably long. Phoebe arrived with her suitcase on Saturday morning. I said, "Golly, Phoebe, are you planning to spend a month here?" When I took her up to my room, she asked if she was going to be sharing the room with me. "Why, no, Phoebe," I said. "We built a whole new extension just for you." "You don't have to be sarcastic," she said. "I was only teasing, Phoebe. But there's only one bed." "Good powers of observation, Phoebe." "I thought you might be sleeping downstairs on the couch. People usually try to make their guests comfortable." She looked around my room. "We're going to be a little crowded in here, aren't we?" I did not answer. I did not bash her over the head. I knew why she was acting this way. She sat down on my bed and bounced on it a couple times. "I guess I'll have to get used to your lumpy mattress, Sal. Mine is very firm. A firm mattress is much better for your back. That's why I have such good posture. The reason you slouch is probably because of this mattress."
"Slouch?" I said.
"Well, you do slouch, Sal. Look in the mirror sometime."
She mashed on my mattress.
"Don't you know anything about having guests? You're supposed to give your guests the best that you have. You're supposed to make some sacrifices, Sal."
"That's what my mother always says.
She says, in life, you have to make some sacrifices."
"I suppose your mother made a great sacrifice when she took off," I said. I couldn't help it. She was really getting on my nerves.
"My mother didn't take off. Someone kidnapped her. She is undergoing tremendous sacrifice at this very moment in time."
She started unpacking.
"Where shall I put my things?"
When I opened up the closet, she said,
"What a mess! Do you have some extra hangers? Am I supposed to leave my clothes jammed up in a suitcase all weekend? A guest is supposed to have the best. It is only courtesy, Sal. My mother says..."
"I know, I know. Sacrifice." 10 minutes later, Phoebe mentioned that she was getting a headache.
"It might even be a migraine. My aunt's foot doctor used to get migraines, only they turned out not to be migraines at all. Do you know what they were?"
"What?" I said.
"A brain tumor."
"Really?" I said.
"Yes," Phoebe said. "In her brain."
"Well, of course it would be in her brain, Phoebe. I figured that out when you said it was a brain tumor."
"I don't think that's a particularly sympathetic way to speak to someone with a migraine or a potential brain tumor."
In my book was a picture of a tree. I drew a round head with curly hair, put a rope around the neck, and attached it to that tree. It went on and on like that. I hated her that day. I didn't care how upset she was about her mother. I really hated her, and I wanted her to leave. I wondered if this was how my father felt when I threw all those temper tantrums. Maybe he hated me for a while. After dinner, we walked over to Mary Lou's. Mr. and Mrs. Finney were rolling around on the front lawn in a pile of leaves with Tommy and Dougie, and Ben was sitting on the porch. I sat down beside him while Phoebe went looking for Mary Lou. Ben said, "Phoebe's driving you crazy, isn't she?"
I liked the way he looked right in your eyes when he talked to you.
"Extensively," I said. "I bet Phoebe is lonely."
I don't know what came over me.
but I almost reached up and touched his face. My heart was thumping so loudly that I thought he would be able to hear it. I went into the house. From the back window, I watched Mrs. Finney climb a ladder placed against the garage. On the roof, she took off her jacket and spread it out. A few minutes later, Mr. Finney came around the back of the house and climbed up the ladder. He took off his jacket and spread it out next to her. He lay down on the roof and put his arm around her. He kissed her. On the roof, in the wide open air, they lay there kissing each other. It made me feel peculiar. They reminded me of my parents before the stillborn baby, before the operation. Ben came into the kitchen. As he reached into the cupboard for a glass, he stopped and looked at me. Again, I had that odd sensation that I wanted to touch his face right there on his cheek in that soft spot. I was afraid my hand might just lift up and drift over to him if I was not careful. It was most peculiar. "Guess where Mary Lou is?" Phoebe said when she came in. "She's with Alex on a date." I had never been on a date. Neither, I assumed, had Phoebe. That night at my house, I pulled the sleeping bag out of the closet and spread it on the floor. Phoebe looked at it as if it were a spider. "Don't worry," I said. "I'll sleep in it." I crawled in and pretended to fall asleep immediately. I heard Phoebe get into bed. A little later, my father came into the room. "Phoebe," he said, "is something the matter?"
"No,"
she said. "I thought I heard someone crying. Are you okay?"
"Yes,"
she said. "Are you sure?"
"Yes."
I felt bad for Phoebe. I knew I should get up and try to be nice, but I remembered when I had felt like that, and I knew that sometimes you just wanted to be alone with the birds of sadness. Sometimes you had to cry by yourself. That night, I dreamed that I was sitting on the grass, peering through a pair of binoculars. Far off in the distance, my mother was climbing up a ladder. She kept climbing and climbing. It was a thumpingly tall ladder. She couldn't see me, and she never came down. She just kept on going. Chapter 27, Pandora's Box. The next day, as I was helping Phoebe lug her suitcase home, I said, "Phoebe, I know you've been upset lately."
"I have not been upset lately," she said.
"Sometimes, Phoebe, I like you a lot."
"Why, thank you."
"But sometimes, Phoebe, I feel like dumping your cholesterol-free body out the window." She did not have a chance to respond because we were at her house, and she was more interested in besieging her father with questions.
"Any news? Did Mom come back? Did she call?"
"Sort of," he said. "She phoned Mrs. Cadaver."
"Mrs. Cadaver? Whatever for? Why would she..."
"Phoebe, calm down. I don't know why she phoned Mrs. Cadaver. I haven't been able to speak to Mrs. Cadaver myself, yet she isn't home. She left a note here." He showed it to Phoebe. "Norma called to say she is okay." Beneath Mrs. Cadaver's signature was a P.S. saying that Mrs. Cadaver would be away until Monday.
"I don't believe that Mom called Mrs. Cadaver. Mrs. Cadaver is making it up. Mrs. Cadaver probably killed her and chopped her up. I'm calling the police."
They had a huge argument, but at last Phoebe fizzled out. Her father said he had been calling everyone he could think of to see if her mother had indicated where she might be going. He would continue calling tomorrow, he promised, and he would speak with Mrs. Cadaver. If he did not receive a letter or a direct phone call from her mother by Wednesday, he would call the police. Phoebe came out on the porch with me as I was leaving. She said, "I've made a decision. I'm going to call the police. I might even go to the police station. I don't have to wait until Wednesday. I can go whenever I want." That night she phoned me. She was whispering again.
"It seems so quiet here. I don't know what is the matter with me. I was lying on my bed and I can't sleep. My bed's too hard."
On Monday, Phoebe gave her oral report on Pandora. She began in a quivering voice.
For some reason, Ben already talked about my topic, Pandora, when he did his report on Prometheus. However, Ben made a few little mistakes about Pandora.
Everyone turned around to stare at Ben. I did not, he said.
Yes, you did.
Phoebe's lip trembled.
Pandora was not sent to man as a punishment, but as a reward.
Was not, Ben said.
Was too, Phoebe said. Zeus decided to give man a present, since man seemed lonely down there on Earth, with only the animals to keep him company. So Zeus made a sweet and beautiful woman, and then Zeus invited all the gods to dinner. It was a very civilized dinner with matching plates.
Mary Lou and Ben exchanged an eyebrow message.
Zeus asked the gods to give the woman presents to make her feel like a welcome guest.
Phoebe glanced at me.
They gave her wonderful things. A fancy shawl, a silver dress, beauty.
Ben interrupted. I thought you said she was already beautiful.
They gave her more beauty. Are you satisfied?
Her lip was no longer trembling, but she was blushing.
The gods also gave her the ability to sing, the power of persuasion, a gold crown, flowers, and many truly wonderful things such as that. Because of all these gifts, Zeus named her Pandora, which means the gift of all.
Phoebe was getting into it.
There were two other gifts that I have not mentioned yet. One of them was curiosity. That is why all women are curious, by the way, because it was a gift given to the very first woman,
Ben said. I wish she had been given the gift of silence.
Last, there was a beautiful box covered in gold and jewels, and, this is very important, she was forbidden to open the box.
Ben said, then why did they give it to her? He was beginning to irritate Phoebe, you could tell. She said,
that's what I'm telling you, it was a present.
But why did they give her a present that she couldn't open?
I do not know, it's just in the story. As I was saying, Pandora was not supposed to open the box, but because she had been given so much curiosity, she really, really, really wanted to know what was inside. So one day she opened the box.
I knew it, Ben said. I knew she was going to open the box the minute that you said she was not supposed to open it.
Inside the box were all the evils in the world, such as hatred, envy, plagues, sickness and cholesterol. There were brain tumors and sadness, lunatics and kidnapping and murders.
She glanced at Mr. Berkway before rushing on.
And all that kind of thing. Pandora tried to close the lid when she saw all the horrible things that were coming out of it, but she could not get it closed, and that is why there are all these evils in the world. There was only one good thing in the box.
What was it? Ben asked.
As I was about to explain, the only good thing in the box was hope, and that is why, even though there are many evils in the world, there is still a little hope.
She held up a picture of Pandora opening up the box, and a whole shebang of gremlins floating out. Pandora looked frightened.
That night I kept thinking about Pandora's box. I wondered why someone would put a good thing, such as hope, in a box with sickness and kidnapping and murder. It was fortunate that it was there, though. If not, people would have the birds of sadness nesting in their hair all the time because of nuclear war and the greenhouse effect and bombs and stabbings and lunatics.
There must have been another box with all the good things in it, like sunshine and love and trees and all that. Who had the good fortune to open that one? And was there one bad thing down there in the bottom of the good box? Maybe it was worry. Even when everything seems fine and good, I worry that something will go wrong and change everything. My mother and my father and I all seemed fine and happy at our house until the baby died.
Could you actually say that the baby died, since it had never breathed?
Did its birth and death occur at the same moment? Could you die before you were born? Phoebe's family had not seemed fine, even before the arrival of the lunatic and the messages and the disappearance of Mrs. Winterbottom. I knew that Phoebe was convinced that her mother was kidnapped because it was impossible for Phoebe to imagine that her mother could leave for any other reason. I wanted to call Phoebe and say that maybe her mother had gone looking for something. Maybe her mother was unhappy. Maybe there was nothing Phoebe could do about it. When I told this part to Graham and Gramps, Gramps said, "You mean it had nothing to do with Phoebe?" They looked at each other. They didn't say anything, but there was something in that look that suggested I had just said something important. For the first time, it occurred to me that maybe my mother's leaving had nothing whatsoever to do with me. It was separate and apart. We couldn't own our mothers. On that night after Phoebe had given her Pandora report, I thought about the hope in Pandora's box. Maybe when everything seemed sad and miserable, Phoebe and I could both hope that something might start to go right. Chapter 28, The Black Hills. When we saw the first sign for the Black Hills, the whispers changed and once again commanded, "Rush, hurry, rush." We had spent too long in South Dakota. There were only 2 days left and a long way to go. "Maybe we should skip the Black Hills," I said. "What?" Gramps said. "Skip the Black Hills? Skip Mount Rushmore? We can't do that." "But today's the 18th. It's the fifth day."
"Do you have a deadline someone didn't tell me about?" Gramps said. "Heck, we've got all the time and..."
Graham gave him a look.
"I've just got to see these Black Hills," Gramps said. "We'll be quick about it, Chickabiddy."
The whispers walloped me. "Rush, rush, rush." I knew we wouldn't make it to Idaho in time. I thought about sneaking off while Graham and Gramps were looking at the Black Hills. Maybe I could hitch a ride with someone who drove fast. But the thought of someone speeding, careening around curves, especially the snaking curves down into Lewiston, Idaho, which I had heard so much about, when I thought about that, it made me dizzy and sick.
"Heck," Gramps said, "I ought to turn this wheel over to you, Chickabiddy. All this driving is making me crazy as a loon."
He was only joking, but he knew I could drive. He had taught me to drive his old pickup truck when I was 11. We used to ride around on the dirt roads on their farm. I drove, and he smoked his pipe and told stories. He said,
"You're a hell of a driver, Chickabiddy. But don't you tell your mom I taught you. She'd thrash me half to death."
I used to love to drive that old green pickup truck. I dreamed about turning 16 and getting my license. But then, when Mama left, something happened to me. I became afraid of things I had never been afraid of before, and driving was one of these things. I didn't even like to ride in cars, let alone drive the truck. The Black Hills were not really black. Pines covered the hills, and maybe at dusk they looked black, but when we saw them at midday, they were dark green. It was an eerie sight, all those rolling dark hills. A cool wind blew down through the pines, and the trees swished secrets among them. My mother had always wanted to see the Black Hills. It was one of the sights she was most looking forward to on her trip. She used to tell me about the Black Hills, which were sacred to the Sioux Indians. It was their holy land, but white settlers took it as their own. The Sioux were still fighting for their land. I half expected a Sioux to stop our car from entering, and the thing is, I would have been on his side. I would have said, "Take it, it's yours." We drove through the Black Hills to Mount Rushmore. At first we didn't think we were in the right place, but then, jing bang, it was right before us. There, high up on a cliff face, were the 60-foot-tall faces of Washington, Jefferson, Lincoln, and Teddy Roosevelt, carved right into the rock, staring somberly down on us. It was fine seeing the presidents. I've got nothing against the presidents. But you'd think the Sioux would be mighty sad to have those white faces carved into their sacred hill. I bet my mother was upset. I wondered why whoever carved them couldn't have put a couple Indians up there, too. Graham and Gramps seemed disappointed as well. Graham didn't even want to get out of the car, so we didn't stay long. Gramps said,
"I've had enough of South Dakota. How about you, Chickabiddy? How about you, Gooseberry? Let's get a move on."
By late afternoon, we were well into Wyoming, and I added up the miles left to go. Maybe we could make it, just maybe. Then Gramps said,
"I hope nobody minds if we stop at Yellowstone. It would be a sin to miss Yellowstone."
Graham said, "Is that where Old Faithful is? Oh, I would love to see Old Faithful." She looked back at me.
We'll hurry. Why, I bet we'll be in Idaho by the 20th without any problem at all.
Chapter 29. The Tide Rises.
Did PB's mother call? Graham said. Did she come home? Did PB phone the police? Oh, I hope this isn't a sad story.
Phoebe did go to the police. It was on the day that Mr. Berkway read us the poem about the tide and the traveler, a poem that upset both me and Phoebe, and I think it is what convinced her finally that she had to tell the police about her mother. Mr. Berkway read a poem by Longfellow, "The Tide Rises, the Tide Falls." The way Mr. Berkway read this poem, you could hear the tide rising and falling. In the poem, a traveler is hurrying toward a town, and it is getting darker and darker, and the sea calls to the traveler, when the waves, with their soft, white hands, wash out the traveler's footprints. The next morning, the day returns, but nevermore returns the traveler to the shore. And the tide rises, the tide falls. Mr. Berkway asked for reactions to this poem. Megan said that it sounded soft and gentle, and it almost made her go to sleep.
Gentle? I said. It's terrifying. My voice was shaking. Someone is walking along the beach, and the night is getting black, and the person keeps looking behind him to see if someone is following, and a jing-bang wave comes up and pulls him into the sea.
A murder, Phoebe said. I went barreling on as if it was my poem and I was an expert.
The waves with their soft white hands grab the traveler. They drown him. They kill him. He's gone.
Ben said, maybe he didn't drown. Maybe he just died like normal people die.
Phoebe said, he drowned. I said, it isn't normal to die. It isn't normal. It's terrible.
Megan said, what about heaven? What about God? Mary Lou said, God? Is he in this poem? Ben said, maybe dying could be normal and terrible. When the bell rang, I raced out of the room. Phoebe grabbed me. Come on, she said. From her locker, she took the evidence she had brought from home, and we both ran the 6 blocks to the police station. I'm not exactly sure why I went along with Phoebe. Maybe it was because of that poem about the traveler, or maybe it was because I had begun to believe in the lunatic, or maybe it was because Phoebe was taking some action and I admired her for it. I wished I had taken some action when my mother left. I was not sure what I could have done, but I wished I had done something. Phoebe and I stood for 5 minutes outside the police station, trying to make our hearts slow down, and then we went inside and stood at the counter. On the other side of it, a thin man with big ears was writing in a black book.
Excuse me, Phoebe said.
I'll be right with you, he said.
This is absolutely urgent. I need to speak to someone about a murder, Phoebe said.
He looked up quickly. A murder?
Yes, Phoebe said. Or possibly a kidnapping, but the kidnapping might turn into a murder.
Is this a joke?
No, it is not a joke, Phoebe said.
Just a minute.
He whispered to a plump woman in a dark blue uniform. She wore glasses with thick lenses.
Is this something you girls have read about in a book? She asked.
No, it is not, I said. That was a turning point, I think, when I came to Phoebe's defense. I didn't like the way the woman was looking at us, as if we were two fools. I wanted that woman to understand why Phoebe was so upset. I wanted her to believe Phoebe.
May I ask who it is who has been kidnapped or possibly murdered? The woman said.
Phoebe said, my mother.
Oh, your mother. Come along, then.
Her voice was sugary and sweet, as if she was speaking to tiny children. We followed her to a room with glass partitions. An enormous man with a huge head and neck and massive shoulders sat behind the desk. His hair was bright red and his face was covered in freckles. He did not smile when we entered. After the woman repeated what we had told her, he stared at us for a long time. His name was Sergeant Bickle, and Phoebe told him everything. She explained about her mother's disappearing, and the note from Mrs. Cadaver, and Mrs. Cadaver's missing husband, and the rhododendron, and finally about the lunatic and the mysterious messages. At this point, Sergeant Bickle said, What sort of messages?
Phoebe was prepared. She pulled them out of her bag and laid them on the desk in the order in which they had arrived. He read each one aloud.
Don't judge a man until you've walked 2 moons in his moccasins. Everyone has his own agenda. In the course of a lifetime, what does it matter? You can't keep the birds of sadness from flying over your head, but you can keep them from nesting in your hair.
Sergeant Bickle looked up at the woman seated next to us, and the corners of his mouth twitched slightly. To Phoebe, he said,
And how do you think these are related to your mother's disappearance?
I don't know, she said. That's what I want you to find out. Sergeant Bickle asked Phoebe to spell Mrs. Cadaver's name.
It means corpse, Phoebe said. Dead body.
I know. Is there anything else?
Phoebe pulled out the envelope with the unidentifiable hair strands.
Perhaps you could have these analyzed, she suggested.
Sergeant Bickle looked at the woman, and again the corners of his mouth twitched slightly. The woman removed her glasses and wiped the lenses. They were not taking us seriously, and I felt my ornery donkey self waking up. I mentioned the potential blood spots that Phoebe had marked with adhesive tape. But my father removed the tape, Phoebe said.
Sergeant Bickle said, I wonder if you would excuse me a few minutes.
He asked the woman to stay with us and he left the room. The woman asked Phoebe about school and about her family. She had an awful lot of questions. I kept wondering where Sergeant Bickle had gone and when he was coming back. He was gone for over an hour. There were 3 framed pictures on Sergeant Bickle's desk, and I tried to lean forward to see them, but I couldn't. I was afraid the woman would think I was nosy. Sergeant Bickle finally returned. Behind him was Phoebe's father. Phoebe looked extensively relieved, but I knew it was not a coincidence that her father was there.
Miss Winterbottom, Sergeant Bickle said, your father is going to take you and your friend home now.
But,
Phoebe said,
Mr. Winterbottom, we'll be in touch. And if you would like me to speak with Mrs. Cadaver...
Oh, no, Mr. Winterbottom said. He looked embarrassed. Really, that won't be necessary. I do apologize.
We followed Mr. Winterbottom outside. In the car, he said nothing. I thought he might drop me off at my house, but he didn't. When we got to their house, the only thing he said was...
Phoebe, I'm going to go talk with Mrs. Cadaver. You and Sal wait here.
Mrs. Cadaver was unable to give him any more information about Phoebe's mother's call. All Mrs. Winterbottom had said was that she would phone soon.
That's all? Phoebe asked.
Your mother also asked Mrs. Cadaver how you and Prudence were. Mrs. Cadaver told her that you and Prudence were fine.
Well, I am not fine, Phoebe said. And what does Mrs. Cadaver know anyway? And besides, Mrs. Cadaver is making the whole thing up. You should let the police talk to her. You should ask her about the rhododendron. You should find out who the lunatic is. Mrs. Cadaver probably hired him. You should...
Phoebe, your imagination is running away with you.
It is not. Mom loves me, and she would not leave me without any explanation.
And then her father began to cry. Chapter 30, Breaking In.
Gol dang, Gramps said. What a lot of birds of sadness wing-dinging their way around Peeby's family.
Gramps said,
You liked Peeby, didn't you, Salamanca?
I did like Phoebe. In spite of all her wild tales and her cholesterol madness and her annoying comments, there was something about Phoebe that was like a magnet. I was drawn to her. I was pretty sure that underneath all that odd behavior was someone who was frightened. And in a strange way, she was like another version of me. She acted out the way I sometimes felt. I do not think that Phoebe actually planned to break into Mrs. Cadaver's house, but as Phoebe was going to bed, she saw Mrs. Cadaver in her nurse's uniform get into her car and leave. Phoebe waited until her father was asleep, and then she phoned me.
You've got to come over, she said. It's urgent.
But, Phoebe, it's late. It's dark.
It's urgent, Sal.
Phoebe was waiting in front of Mrs. Cadaver's house. There were no lights on at Mrs. Cadaver's. Phoebe said, Come on, and she started up the walk.
I admit that I was reluctant. "I just want to take a quick look," she said. She crept up onto the porch and stood by the door. She listened, tapped twice, and turned the doorknob. The door was unlocked. I don't think Phoebe intended to go inside, but she did, and I followed. We stood in the dark hallway. In the room to the right, a shaft of light from the street lamp came in through the window. We went into that room. We both nearly leaped through the window when someone said, "Sal?" I started backing toward the door.
"It's a ghost,"
Phoebe said. "Come here," the voice said. As my eyes adjusted to the dim light, I could see someone huddled in a chair in the far corner. When I saw the cane, I was relieved.
"Mrs. Partridge?"
"Come over here," she said. "Who's that with you? Is that Phoebe?" Phoebe said,
"Yes."
Her voice was high and quivery.
"I was just sitting here reading," Mrs. Partridge said.
"Isn't it awfully dark in here?" I said, bumping a table. Mrs. Partridge laughed her wicked laugh.
"It's always dark in here. I don't need lights, but you can turn some on if you want to."
As I stumbled around looking for a lamp, Phoebe stood frozen near the doorway.
"There," I said, "that's much better."
Mrs. Partridge was sitting in a big, overstuffed chair. She was wearing a purple bathrobe and pink slippers with floppy bunny ears at the toes. On her lap was a book, her fingers resting on the page. "Is it Braille?" I asked, waving at Phoebe to come into the room. I was afraid she was going to run out and leave me. Mrs. Partridge handed me the book, and I slid my fingers over the raised bumps.
"How did you know it was us?"
I asked.
"I just knew," she said. "Your shoes make a particular sound, and you have a particular smell."
"What's the name of this book? What's it about?"
Mrs. Partridge said. "Murder at Midnight. It's a mystery."
Phoebe said, "Erp," and looked around the room. Each time I went into that house, I noticed new things. It was a scary place. The walls were lined with shelves crammed with old, musty books. On the floor were three rugs with dark, swirly patterns of wild beasts and forests. Two chairs were covered in similar, ghastly designs. A sofa was draped in a bear skin. On the wall behind the couch were two thumpingly grim African masks. The mouths on the masks were wide open, as if in the midst of a scream. Everywhere you looked, there was something startling. A stuffed squirrel, a kite in the shape of a dragon, a wooden cow with a spear piercing its side.
"Goodness," Phoebe said. "What a lot of unusual things."
She knelt to examine a spot on the floor.
"What's the matter?"
Mrs. Partridge said.
Phoebe jumped up. "Nothing, nothing whatsoever." "Did I drop something on the floor?"
Mrs. Partridge asked.
"No. Nothing whatsoever on the floor," Phoebe said.
Leaning against the back of the sofa was an enormous sword. Phoebe examined the blade.
"Careful you don't cut yourself,"
Mrs. Partridge said. Phoebe stepped back. Even I found this unsettling, that Mrs. Partridge could see what Phoebe was doing, even though she couldn't actually see her. Mrs. Partridge said,
"Isn't this a grandiful room?"
"Grandiful, and a little peculable, too, I suppose." "Phoebe and I have to be going." We backed toward the door.
"By the way,"
Mrs. Partridge said as we reached the doorway,
"what was it you wanted?"
Phoebe looked at me and I looked at Phoebe.
"We were just passing by," I said, "and we thought we would see how you were doing."
"That's nice," Mrs. Partridge said, patting her knees.
"Oh, Phoebe, I think I met your brother."
Phoebe said, "I don't have a brother."
"Oh?"
Mrs. Partridge tapped her head.
"I guess this old noggin isn't as sharp as it used to be."
As we left, she said,
"Goodness, you girls stay up late."
Outside, Phoebe said, "I'll make a list of items which the police will want to investigate further. The sword, the suspicious spot on the floor, and several hair strands which I picked up." "Phoebe, you know when you said that your mother would never leave without an explanation?"
"Well, she might. A person, a mother, might do that."
Phoebe said,
"My mother wouldn't. My mother loves me."
"But she might love you and still not have been able to explain." I was thinking about the letter my mother left me. "Maybe it would be too painful for her to explain. Maybe it would seem too permanent.
I don't know what in the world you're talking about.
She might not come back, Phoebe.
Shut up, Sal.
She might not. I just think you should be prepared.
She is too coming back. You don't know what you're talking about. You're being horrid.
Phoebe ran into the house. When I got home and had crept up to my room, I remembered how Phoebe had shown me some things in her room that reminded her of her mother. A handmade birthday card, a photograph of Phoebe and her mother, and a bar of lavender soap. When Phoebe pulled a blouse out of the closet, she said she could see her mother standing at the ironing board smoothing the blouse with her hand. The wall opposite Phoebe's bed was painted violet. She said, "My mother painted it last summer while I painted the trim at the bottom." And I knew exactly what Phoebe was doing and exactly why. I had done the same things when my mother left. My father was right. My mother did haunt our house in Bybanks, and the fields and the barn. She was everywhere. You couldn't look at a single thing without being reminded of her. When we moved to Euclid, one of the first things I did was to unpack gifts my mother had given me. On the wall, I tacked the poster of the red hen which my mother had given me for my 5th birthday, and the drawing of the barn she had given me for my last birthday. On my desk were pictures of her and cards from her. On the bookshelf, the wooden animals and books were presents from her. Sometimes I would walk around the room and look at each of these things and try to remember exactly the day she had given them to me. I tried to picture what the weather was like and what room we were in and what she was wearing and what precisely she had said. This was not a game. It was a necessary, crucial thing to do. If I did not have these things and remember these occasions, then she might disappear forever. She might never have been. In my bureau were 3 things of hers that I had taken from her closet after she left. A red fringed shawl, a blue sweater, and a yellow flowered cotton dress that was always my favorite. These things had her smell on them. Once, before she left, my mother had said that if you visualize something happening, you can make it happen. For example, if you are about to run a race, you visualize yourself running the race and crossing the finish line first. And presto, when the time comes, it really happens. The only thing I did not understand was what if everyone visualized himself winning the race? Still, when she left, this is what I did. I visualized her reaching for the phone. Then I visualized her dialing the phone. I visualized our phone number clicking through the wires. I visualized the phone ringing. It did not ring. I visualized her riding the bus back to Bybanks. I visualized her walking up the driveway. I visualized her opening the door. It did not happen. Well, I was thinking about all of this that night after Phoebe and I crept into Mrs. Cadaver's house. I also thought about Ben. I had the sudden urge to run over to the Finneys and ask him where his own mother was, but it was too late. The Finneys would be asleep. Instead, I lay there thinking of the poem about the traveler, and I could see the tide rising and falling, and those horrid white hands snatching the traveler. How could it be normal, that traveler dying? And how could such a thing be normal and terrible both at the same time? I stayed awake the whole night. I knew that if I closed my eyes, I would see the tide and the white hands. I thought about Mr. Winterbottom crying. That was the saddest thing. It was sadder than seeing my own father cry, because my father is the sort of person you expect might cry if he was terribly upset. But I had never, ever expected Mr. Winterbottom, stiff Mr. Winterbottom, to cry. It was the first time I realized that he actually cared about Mrs. Winterbottom. As soon as it was daylight, I phoned Phoebe. "Phoebe, we've got to find her. That's what I've been telling you," she said. Chapter 31. The Photograph. The next day was most peculable, as Mrs. Partridge would say. Phoebe arrived at school with another message which she had found on her porch that morning. "We never know the worth of water until the well is dry." "It's a clue," Phoebe said. "Maybe my mother is hidden in a well." I walked straight into Ben when I went to my locker. That grapefruit aroma was in the air.
"You've got something on your face," he said.
With soft, warm fingers, he rubbed the side of my face.
"It's probably your breakfast."
I don't know what came over me. I was going to kiss him. I leaned forward just as he turned around and slammed the door of his locker. My lips ended up pressed against the cold metal locker.
"You're weird, Sal," he said.
Kissing was thumpingly complicated. Both people had to be in the same place at the same time, and both people had to remain still so that the kiss ended up in the right place. But I was relieved that my lips had ended up on the cold metal locker. I could not imagine what had come over me, or what might have happened if the kiss had landed on Ben's mouth. It was a shivery thing to consider. I made it through the rest of my classes without losing control of my lips. Mr. Berkway sailed into class carrying our journals. I had forgotten all about them. He was leaping all over the place exclaiming, "Dynamite! Unbelievable! Incredible!" He said he couldn't wait to share the journals with the class. Mary Lou Finney said, "Share with the class?" Mr. Berkway said, "Not to worry. Everyone has something magnificent to say. I haven't read through every page yet, but I wanted to share some of the passages with you right away." People were squirming all over the room. I was trying to remember what I had written. Mary Lou leaned over to me and said, "Well, I'm not worried. I wrote a special note in the front of mine distinctly asking him not to read it. Mine was private." Mr. Berkway smiled at each nervous face. "You needn't worry," he said. "I'll change the names that you've used, and I'll fold this piece of yellow paper over the cover of whichever journal I'm reading so that you won't know whose it is." Ben asked if he could go to the bathroom. Christy said she felt sick and begged to see the nurse. Phoebe asked me to touch her forehead because she was pretty sure she had a fever. Usually Mr. Berkway would let people go to the bathroom or to the nurse, but this time he said, "Let's not malinger." He picked up a journal, slipping the yellow paper over it before anyone had a chance to examine the cover for clues as to its author's identity. Everyone took a deep breath. You could see people poised nervously, waiting as tensely as if Mr. Berkway was going to announce someone's execution. Mr. Berkway read, "I think that Betty," he changed the name, you could tell, because there was no Betty in our school, "will go to hell because she always takes the Lord's name in vain. She says God every 5 seconds." Mary Lou Finney was turning purple. "Who wrote that?" she said. "Did you, Christy? I bet you did." Christy stared down at her desk. "I do not say God every 5 seconds. I do not, and I am not going to hell. Omnipotent, that's what I say now. I say omnipotent and Alpha and Omega." Mr. Berkway was desperately trying to explain what he had enjoyed about that passage. He said that most of us are not aware that we might be using words such as God that offend other people. Mary Lou leaned over to me and said, "Is he serious? Does he actually, really, and truly believe that beef-brained Christy is troubled by my saying God? Which I do not, by the way, say anymore anyway." Christy wore a pious look, as if God himself had just come down from heaven to sit on her desk. Mr. Berkway quickly selected another journal. He read, "Linda," there was no Linda in our class either, "is my best friend. I tell her just about everything, and she tells me everything, even things that I do not want to know, like what she ate for breakfast and what her father wears to bed and how much her new sweater cost. Sometimes things like that are just not interesting." Mr. Berkway liked this passage because it showed that even though someone might be our best friend, he or she could still drive us crazy. Beth Ann turned all the way around in her seat and sent wicked eyebrow messages to Mary Lou. Mr. Berkway flipped ahead in the same journal to another passage. He read, "I think Jeremiah is pig-headed. His skin is always pink and his hair is always clean and shiny, but he is really a jerk." I thought Mary Lou Finney was going to fall out of her chair. Alex was bright, bright pink. He looked at Mary Lou as if she had recently plunged a red-hot stake into his heart. Mary Lou said, No, it isn't what you think. Mr. Berkway liked this passage because it showed conflicting feelings about someone.
"I'll say it does," Alex said. The bell rang. First, you could hear sighs of relief from the people whose journals had not been read, and then people started talking a mile a minute. "Hey, Mary Lou, look at Alex's pink skin." And, "Hey, Mary Lou, what does Beth Ann's father wear to bed?" Beth Ann was standing 1 inch away from Mary Lou's face. "I do not talk on and on," Beth Ann said. "And that wasn't very nice of you to mention that. And I do not tell you everything, and the only reason I ever mentioned what my father wore to bed was because we were talking, if you will recall, about men's bathing suits being more comfortable than women's," and on she went. Mary Lou was trying to get across the room to Alex, who was standing there as pink as can be. "Alex," she called. "Wait, I wrote that before. Wait." It was a jing-bang of a mess. I was glad I had to get out of there. Phoebe and I were going to the police again. We got in to see Sergeant Bickle right away. Phoebe slapped the newest message about the water in the well onto his desk, dumped the hairs which she had collected at Mrs. Cadaver's house on top of the message, and then placed her list of further items to investigate on top of that. Sergeant Bickle frowned. "I don't think you girls understand." Phoebe went into a rage. "You idiot!" she said. She scooped up the message, the hairs, and her list, and stormed out of the office. Sergeant Bickle followed her while I waited, thinking he would bring Phoebe back and calm her down. I looked at the photographs on his desk, the ones I had not been able to see the day before. In one was Sergeant Bickle and a friendly-looking woman, his wife, I suppose. The second picture was of a shiny black car. The third picture was of Sergeant Bickle, the woman, and a young man, their son, I figured. I looked closer. I recognized the son. It was the lunatic. Chapter 32. Chicken and Blackberry Kisses. Gramps barreled through Wyoming like a house of fire. We snaked through winding roads where the trees leaned close, rustling, rush, 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 rush. The road curved alongside rivers that rolled and gabled. Hurry, hurry, hurry. It was late when we arrived at Yellowstone. All we got to see that evening was a hot spring. We walked on boardwalks placed across the bubbling mud. "Huzzah, huzzah," Graham said. And we stayed at the Old Faithful Inn in a frontier cabin. I had never seen Graham so excited. She could not wait for the next morning. "We're going to see Old Faithful," she said over and over. "It won't take too very long, will it?" I said, and I felt like a mule saying it because Graham was so looking forward to it.
"Don't you worry, Salamanca," Graham said. "We'll just watch that old geyser blow, and then we'll hit the road."
I prayed all night long to the elm tree outside. I prayed that we would not get in an accident, that we would get to Lewiston, Idaho in time for my mother's birthday, and that we would bring her home. Later I would realize that I had prayed for the wrong things. That night, Graham was so excited that she could not sleep. She rambled on about all sorts of things. She said to Gramps,
"Remember that letter from the Eggman that you found under the mattress?"
"Of course I remember. We had a wing-ding of an argument over it. You told me you had no dang idea how it got there. You said the Eggman must have slipped into the bedroom and put it there."
"Well, I want you to know that I put it there."
"I know that," Gramps said. "I'm not a complete noodle."
"It's the only love letter anybody ever wrote me," Graham said. "You never wrote me any love letters."
"You never told me you wanted one."
"To me," Graham said.
"Your grandfather nearly killed the Eggman over that letter."
"Hell's bells," Gramps said. "He wasn't worth killing."
"Maybe not, but Gloria was."
"Ah, yes," Gramps said, placing his hand on his heart and pretending to swoon. "Gloria."
"Cut that out,"
Graham said, rolling over on her side.
"Tell me about P.B. Tell me that story. But don't make it too awfully sad."
She folded her hands on her chest.
"Tell me what happened with the lunatic."
When I saw the picture of the lunatic on Sergeant Bickle's desk, I tore out of that office faster than lightning. I ran past Sergeant Bickle standing in the parking lot, no sign of Phoebe. I ran all the way to her house. As I passed Mrs. Cadaver's house, Mrs. Partridge called to me from her porch. "You're all dressed up," I said. "Going somewhere?" "Oh, yes," she said. "I'm readable."